Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S., designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff.
Hey, you guys.
Hello.
This is the rare real-time introduction, as in approximately 3 minutes I will be doing this interview with Thomas Morton, who was with Vice for a long time, originally Vice the magazine, and then some of their TV ventures. Been on the HBO show. He's someone whose writing I've liked for a while. I feel like one of the early stories when we were first starting Longform that we were both quite excited by was a story he wrote about simultaneously joining three different New York City cults.
Sounds like something you and I would like.
Yes. But he bubbled to my mind again because he published a story on Medium. So I'm just going to say, I'm guessing that people who listen to the show will be aware of this. Jill Abramson, former editor of The New York Times, published a book called The Merchants of Truth.
That's right.
That is about four news organizations, but one of them is Vice. And in the Vice chapter, she tells the story through the lens of a young reporter named Thomas Morton. And I first came across this piece he wrote on Medium where he was basically like, this is like a cruel joke to see my life depicted that way. Also, I'm massively misquoted in this book. He said that in a much more entertaining way than I'm currently depicting it. And I was like, that's interesting, filing this away. And since then, since booking him for this show, I think this is the rare time where we've gotten more excited for an interview before it even happened. There's been a lot of allegations of plagiarism by Jill Abramson in that book. And I would say he appears to be somewhat vindicated in his belief that some of the things he is said to be saying in this book, he may not have said in the interview.
Aaron, you're really on the news with this interview.
Look, we're only on the news about once every 3 years, and it's kind of like a comet that's circling a planet. We just we can't miss 50 times a year. So we're on the news cycle this week. Coming to you in real time here.
Yeah, it's fun. None of us know what's going to happen, what this guy's going to say.
Yeah. Do you guys have any questions you want me to ask him? You know, Medium's one great way to get your message out if you've been misquoted in your life story as adaptation into a Jill Abramson book. Another one would be an email newsletter if it's an ongoing story. Which this one appears to be. They make it really easy to start one that can grow as your list does. You don't even have to pay for it until a certain number of people sign up. So check them out. Thanks to MailChimp.
MailChimp has a nice feature, too, where if you copy and paste from somewhere, it keeps the formatting.
Ooh, Max. maybe your spiciest appearance ever on this podcast. I feel like
they don't actually have that feature.
We don't really know how to be topical. They're real cold or just flaming hot.
And here comes Aaron's guest, Thomas Morton.
Welcome, Thomas Morton.
Thank you. Hi.
Strange week. Strange, what is it, a couple weeks, 10 days? How long ago did that Medium piece you published came out?
I think that was 2 weeks ago, but then it kind of sat dormant for a week, and then Michael Moynihan posted all the stuff about plagiarism in the book, and that's when it kind of picked up.
I'm going to, I rarely do this on the show, but I'm going to disclaimer here that my wife works at what is now your former employer, Vice, your longtime employer, Vice. And so I was a bit aware of the stuff that it was going around. She was like, oh, people are freaking out about this Jill Abramson book. And the dumb lizard brain in my head sort of went, oh, like no one likes to see themselves.
Of course,
depicted
yeah.
in journalism.
No one likes
like,
to see themselves depicted.
Almost everyone has been unhappy with how they came across in a profile.
Of course.
But you were asked, a little over a year ago, I think, to do this interview for the book.
Yeah. I wish I could remember the exact timing. It was sometime in the last year. It was probably around this time last year, maybe early spring or so. Yeah. I think Jill was talking to a lot of people at Vice, and I can't remember if she reached out directly or if like one of our communications people was like, hey, do you want to do this? But either way, yeah.
When you're talking to them like that, I mean, you were unaware that you would be, or that,
oh, that
your
they,
story...
they write an entire chapter about me, yeah.
Yeah,
no,
you
I
were unaware that your story would be elevated above, say, the story of other people who are being interviewed.
Right, yeah, I couldn't imagine it being more interesting than anybody else's in terms of what we talked about. I felt like I was mostly just giving her background on the company.
So you started at Vice when?
2004.
So yeah. You are were until recently one of the most longstanding Vice employees. You
I
are
think
not.
I think I was within the top five longest employees. Yeah.
What did she want to know?
What did she want to know?
Yeah.
Whole deal. I basically walked her through the history of the company from my perspective from 2004 up to, that morning with, pretty heavy emphasis on things that I was a part of and like projects. But it was in truth, it was a lot less my story than what was going on with the company. A lot of the people, the important people at the various phases of Vice who are, heading up, when I landed, there was still just the magazine and like the record labels going on, that kind of stuff. But there was no real video work to speak of. And, Jesse Pearson, who was the editor at the time, was, hired me and was my mentor pretty much after Gavin left, the deciding person as far as editorial content went in the company for both. And when they got started with video, did a lot of that. And then there'd be, through the different phases that Vice went through, the different shifts, there'd be different people who'd come on. But there was always, two or three people who were kind of like, the essential players of the time who kind of like, usually for better, kind of embodied whatever spirit the company kind of was riding on. And, and so I think that, I feel like that was more what I talked about with Jill than myself, but there's a lot about myself in there too. And I think I did get into a little bit, she probably asked a little bit of background about how I landed at the company, which involves, being a fan of the magazine and writing to them and coming and taking an internship and that kind of stuff. So, I certainly didn't think that there was going to be 75 pages that were 60 of which were just me. And weren't me. Had my name.
Yeah, I
some
mean,
sort of weird
so I encourage people to to read Thomas's Medium piece because we don't have enough time to go over all of the ways in which Thomas in the book differs from you. I'll just cite one of them that you bring up as sort of a repeated gag in the story, which is that she says that you became aware of Vice after you came across it at your favorite streetwear store.
That, my blood literally boils every time I hear that.
I think you're a little younger than me, but we're, children of the early 80s, I think.
Right, yeah, 36. What are you?
I'm 37.
Okay, good.
So I don't even remember streetwear existing in 2004 as a term, and I actually was wondering if some of the inaccuracies feel like a weird game of telephone being played across generations.
Right? Yeah. And it's what's been kind of fun about all the mistakes in the book is reading through them, and reading through them the first time, I was just kind of baffled. But when I went back and looked at it, I could see where the pieces came from. Every weird just piece of false information always has some, like, just like one little puzzle piece that relates to something that did happen at some point,
yeah,
and was just completely rearranged and put in a context that doesn't make any sense, and, like, you know, move 10 years in, you know, one direction or the other. I mean, the streetwear thing, I don't know. That just, like, that is one that I still haven't found a source for. I remember it in the context of, like, Vice making fun of it as a term. That was probably where I came, like, first, like, remember seeing the term streetwear.
You know? So is it, like, possible? I mean, I don't want to, like, litigate this whole thing, but I am curious about this as a sort of a confluence of multiple strands I'm interested in. Like, did you maybe say, like, I saw Vice when I was buying shoes or something like that? Or, like,
Have you been able to
unpack where you think these, like, inaccuracies started, I guess, is my question?
Well, one thing that was really helpful about when Michael Moynihan posted all the plagiarized passages, aside from bringing light to the whole thing and getting exposure.
I'll say that when I asked you to come on the show, that information
hadn't
even happened yet. Yeah, so you must be feeling some sense of vindication right now.
A mixed one. Okay, because it's funny. People put a lot more weight on plagiarism than they do, like, libel, it seems. And, you know, I think, you know, both are obviously grave offenses when you're writing, like, nonfiction, especially when you're, you know, a former executive editor of the New York Times and have that next to your name anytime you're trotting out your journalistic credentials. Whatever, you know, I think it's, you know, we're late capitalist, and so it's like you take somebody's property, that's a far graver offense than just saying something bad about them, even though the bad things said are just, you know, like, literally textbook libel.
Well, I think that one of those things is just, like, maybe easier to demonstrate in, say, a tweet at the tweet scale. Like, your article requires you to invest, like, a good half an hour.
That's true.
In it, and I think people are very willing to make a very tiny thing. But I think they're all parts of the same puzzle.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
regardless of sort of what people attach themselves to, I am interested in this. I mean, to set out to tell a story about Vice, this upstart company, and say they're kind of trying too hard to be cool and were reckless as a result, and then it turns out that the thing saying that itself was kind of reckless and sloppy is, like,
the ironing, like, is delicious.
Yeah, right? And I, like, it was like when you said mixed verdict, I was almost like, there needs to be, like, a German word for that, where you're kind of like proven to be somewhat right, but you wouldn't choose for that outcome anyway. So what was that experience of reading about yourself and seeing this other person like?
It was infuriating, but in kind of, like, the way that, you know, listening to, like, some talk radio guy can be infuriating, you know? Like, I didn't feel like this great trust I established with Jill Abramson has been broken, and how dare she? But I did feel like, how dare she? It was, you know, it was like, I mean, just the brazenness of it, like, the flagrancy of the errors was, I mean, I'm still just kind of, like, gobsmacked by it. It's, and it was funny, too, because I was, the way I found out about it was the review copy I got my hands on wasn't sent to me or anything like that. Like, I had a friend who was reviewing the book who texted me that, and he was like, hey, you're in this thing.
Yeah.
Like, there's a whole chapter about you. And I was like, and at the time, because I'd had no communication from Jill Abramson or any of her people or Simon Schuster or anything like that, I'd forgotten doing that interview. And for, you know, a good 20 minutes, I was sort of like, did she just make up everything about me? Like, did I ever even talk to this person? And I went back and I was like, all right, there was that.
Am I a real person? Yeah. Even? Who is Thomas Morton?
So it took, it was a long process because I had to go back and dig up whatever email I had relating to that and remember what I'd talked to her about and that kind of stuff. And then, you know, I went through the book a couple times. It wasn't very dramatic. It was just kind of like this slowly escalating, like, are you fucking kidding me?
And it comes amidst some other dispiriting stuff, advice, a bunch of layoffs.
Yeah, yeah.
Which also crossed paths with your life.
Yeah, yeah.
So you no longer are working at Vice.
Nope.
You were laid off after, 2004, 15 years?
Going into my 15th year.
15th
so
year.
14, like 14 and three quarters.
This is basically like your whole adult life.
Yeah, if you want to call it adult, sure.
maybe I do want to talk a little bit more about the Jill Abramson stuff, but I feel like since you were denied the chance to tell your career story in this book, maybe we could talk through it and sort of catch up to speed for the things that are not in Merchants of Truth. So how did you get interested in journalism? What path led you to Vice in the first place?
I would say I've never been interested in journalism and performing journalism. It's maybe a kind of deep in the weeds semantic distinction. It comes up very often. It used to come up a lot less before kind of Vice attached news to their name. And, you know, we started getting kind of put in the same camp as kind of major news media. And, you know, and if you ever want to criticize somebody who, like, does something in documentary or writes nonfiction, you know, like, calling them a journalist and then saying they're a lousy journalist is a very easy way to do it, because there's all sorts of ways you can screw up journalism, like capital J, J-school institutional journalism.
Yeah.
That don't necessarily mean you're a bad storyteller or you're dishonest or any of that. So I would say I was particularly... in high school, I worked at the school newspaper, which I had a lot of fun at. I just think it was like 1999 or something, and so I just discovered The Onion, and the teacher who sponsored the newspaper had like a cousin at Harvard, I think, and so we got copies of The Lampoon that she would bring us, and like I was with, you know, a bunch of friends, we were very creative and funny, and we essentially turned the newspaper into a humor magazine. Roughly,
you know, funny how like actually. College or high school media often is either extremely serious or extremely unserious.
Yeah,
it's very rarely like tiptoeing between those lines.
No, it's true. And we had like two camps in the school newspaper. You know, there was like the five or six kids who wanted to win awards and go out and like break stories, and like they were, you know, on their way to Columbia Journalism School or Missouri or wherever. And then there was the rest of us clowns who were like, you know, literally just like making up stories, like it was fun. It was goofy though.
And this is where?
This was in suburban Atlanta. So this is in East Cobb County, Georgia, in high school.
And where did that lead you?
to the principal's office a few times. I don't know that it spiritually connected with later stuff, but it didn't. Like, I didn't know. I didn't get. That paper didn't get me anywhere. I went to NYU for college, and I was doing an English degree. I decided that pretty early on, and I was dabbling in kind of doing a second degree or minoring or whatever in journalism, and I took the very basic classes, like Reporting 1 and things like that, and I realized immediately, like, it was just not for me. It was a bad fit. I didn't like any of it. I didn't like their approach to writing. I didn't like their approach to storytelling. I didn't like their approach to how you treated subjects, which I felt was very, there was a sense of superiority that it felt like they were trying to directly instill in, like, you know, 18-year-old kids. I didn't, as I learned more and more about the ethics that they were teaching, I came to a sense that, by and large, most of them were not directed towards, you know, improving the veracity of stories or, you know, ensuring the integrity of story, like the reporters or storytellers, and that a lot of them were to cover the bases of the people with money, the publishers, the people putting out the media and things like that. And they were often things that worked to the detriment of reporters. You know, there's, I think, a classic rule where it's, you know, you're not supposed to exchange gifts down to the hard level, you know, never buy a subject coffee or never let them buy you coffee. And the reasoning being, supposedly, it's like, well, then you can't tell, you know, if they're just saying what you want them to say or whatever. And it's like, well, a reporter can tell that. A good one can, you know? And if somebody's willing to change their complete story for a cup of coffee, you know, for $1.50, a cup of brown water, like, that's a really bad subject. And you shouldn't [S2] Right. [S1] Be talking to them in the first place. But the real reason that rule exists, as it does, you know, for, like, police and stuff like that, is that in the event that somebody wants to get you in trouble, wants to, like, call you out and try to discredit your story, that would be an embarrassment to your editor and your publisher and those kind of things. And it, you know, it's, you're playing it safe on their behalf. It's, you know, in the event of, like, this, you know, some sort of coffee gate, it would be very easy for a reporter to just say, I believe this guy, what he told me. It doesn't matter that I picked up a bill for a cup of coffee or, you know, a beer or a pizza or something like that. I would stand behind it and da-da-da-da. But when you get into an institutional level.
Well, let me just push back there against 18-year-old Thomas Morton.
This is also 37-year-old Thomas
Morton. NYU freshman. So you would agree that the coffee cup, like, there's no way you're going to deeply manipulate a story with a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
But if you heard, I paid this source $10,000, it would be a major flag. And I think a lot of like where these sort of like capital journalism with a J sort of laws and regulations come down is almost like people can't have, it's sort of like when you're pregnant, you're not like America tells you don't drink anything.
Right, you
can drink like a glass of red wine. Yeah. People do it in France.
Live your life,
but I almost feel like the FDA is sort of right where they're like, Americans can't handle this shit. What are you joking? Like, we're not going to be able to thread the needle on this. Just don't drink. Like, people are going to drink a six pack if
but
you
let them.
But I think
that's a bad attitude to take towards people, especially like, you know, I mean, the FDA and Americans and pregnancy is something where you could, you know, damage another person's life. Like,
it's slightly different than reporting.
It's a great idea to be, you know, to play it super safe on that. But I don't feel like the benefits of playing it super safe in reporting and storytelling, I feel like can really hinder. I mean, storytelling at its basis, reporting at its basis on a person-to-person level with subjects is human interaction.
Right.
You're supposed to go to people and talk to them and ask them questions and learn things from them. And in the course of doing that, like, you know, suddenly shutting off and being like, oh, I can't take, you know, oh, you got me coffee. Oh, I cannot touch this.
Right.
Like, is a really kind of alienating behavior to partake in and can really be very off-putting too.
Right.
And so, yeah, naturally there's like, I feel like the degrees make perfect sense. And I think somebody, you definitely could sway somebody to say something for you for a few hundred dollars or a few thousand dollars. But that's like, you're not doing proper reporting at that point. You're not doing proper storytelling, and it's not even a matter of what degree it was at. You know, I just think that the rules are there to protect the paper, and at the end of the day, to protect the publisher. It doesn't help you write the story.
What was it like for you? Like, you're this NYU freshman, you're having all these revelations.
Might have been sophomore.
Sophomore. And then, like, fast forward 10 years, Vice has started a internet TV station, one of the first of its kind, really, VBS TV, and you're in some far-flung locale, like being actually confronted by someone saying like, hey, you know, what's in this for me? You know, like I'd like to be compensated a little bit like that. Like, what was it like when these sort of journalism ideas that you encountered first in school, like actually came into play, like while out in the field telling stories?
Well, it all made sense. Like by the point in which we were filming videos, and I was in different countries and stuff like that, I'd had, you know, 4 or 5 years of practice meeting people and going out and reporting stories. The video work we did, one of the things I'm really grateful for is there was no, like, I've never been trained in broadcast anything, in broadcast reporting, in documentary filmmaking, anything of that nature. Like, we're really, like, at least I was really, like, left to my own devices to, like, figure that stuff out on the ground. And it was a lot of fun, first of all, first and foremost. And with that fun came a lot of like really quick understanding of what works and what doesn't, you know, what rules are good and are there for a reason and what rules are just, you know, kind of stentorian bullshit that has just been passed down for generations and are the rules because they're the rules. And compensation's an interesting one because, you know, especially with when you're filming somebody, if you're, you know, interrupting their working life and like taking time away from them and like getting them to, you know, take you places and travel somewhere like that, you know, you can be putting somebody you'd be making someone go out of pocket for fairly decent expenses. And especially if you're, you know, dealing with somebody who's not of incredible means to begin with, it's a, it can be a burden.
Yeah.
And so I think the degrees, that, you know, and it's like, well, that gets murky if you have degrees. Like, what's the cutoff? And there isn't a cutoff. You have to go with your gut. And I feel like that's really one of the most essential qualities in doing anything of the nature of what we did, of making, you know, documentaries or reporting news or current events or anything like that, is you have to, like, you really have to have a good sense of intuition for who you're dealing with, what they're telling you, what you're telling them, how you're behaving. It's all human interaction. You can't govern that with hard and fast rule, or just like not with extreme set rules beyond the extreme ones. There's always going to be murky areas and stuff like that. And you have to be willing to accept that and work with those.
So you started at Vice in 2004. Mm-hmm. This video stuff started coming in.
We started making
07, maybe. 06?
Yeah, we started. We put up VBS started in 2007, so we were starting in like 2006.
All right. So in that run, from you were an intern at Vice when you first started. To the point where only a few years later, you're like doing on-camera talent stuff for them. After having written a bunch of feature kind of stuff for the magazine. One of my favorite stories you did, I think probably the way I originally encountered your writing was a story you did about joining three cults in New York City simultaneously.
Yeah, that was fun.
Well, I was actually just thinking about that question. Was one of those cults, no, it couldn't have been because that's a all-women's cult. Nexium.
Nexium, no. It was Adidam, which was like a guru cult. The Moonies, which is the Unification Church from Korea, and Scientology. And I had to take out the whole section on Scientology because of how litigious they are, and because having been involved with them for a month at that point, I was deeply on the hook with like paperwork and stuff like that, and so I subbed it out for Aleph, which is the current name for the Japanese cult that used to be called Aum Shinrikyo. Were the guys who gassed the sarin gas at the Tokyo subway in 1985.
I would say the Aum Shinrikyo Wikipedia page, top 10 Wikipedia pages ever. It's got rabbit holes inside of rabbit holes.
And yeah, the story's crazy. They were supervillains. It was like they were the closest thing we have to like Cobra from G.I. Joe existing.
So actually that cult story is a good segue to what I wanted to ask you about the period anyway, which is, so as Vice transitioned from being, without putting too much emphasis on this, like the old Vice or the new Vice or the changes in the media, Vice started doing forms of storytelling, whether you call them journalism or nonfiction, that were increasingly ambitious and put their reporters in, whether you call them reporters, in new places. And when more traditional media companies do that, they often have these rules, we discussed, this sort of these existing norms. And when a newer person comes in, for better or worse, there's at least a framework that those people are working with. And it seems to me like you were not in necessarily a framework that explained what to do when Scientology threatened litigation against you.
Well, I went to a lawyer, though. It was intuitive. There wasn't, the one thing I'd always point out is like we were never like reckless people, it always dispirits me to see us described as kind of like idiots, because the people I worked for were extremely smart. Like Jesse Pearson's one of the smartest, best writers I think I've ever worked for. And that was what drew me to the magazine. I think that's, if you're a person who kind of like reads things and you look at 2004, 2005 Vice versus like some of the things it gets compared to, like Maxim and shit like that. Like I would hope that the difference in quality is very, very obvious.
I think what I'm interested in is how that quality manifests from a void, and how a bunch of smart people who don't necessarily have a model for what they're doing and in some ways are zagging against existing models, how do you find order and how do you find tone and editorial voice within that? I mean, what was the newsroom of whatever Vice called the newsroom at that time like?
Well, it's fun. It's almost like being like, if you've ever been in a band and you kind of like, and people kind of start, speaking the same musical language and like hitting the same notes and stuff like that. And there's kind of like a spark of energy to it that's like really exciting. Like, a lot of a lot of the motivation that I witnessed and that came from, like, that I felt was about what we hated in the media and just like avoiding some of the traps and pitfalls, avoiding the things that we saw being done by the mainstream media and other players in it that turned our stomachs, or just caused us to cringe. And the order kind of, order emerges like when you set your mind to it. If anybody's ever kind of like sat down and written something of length, or done anything creative, like I imagine painting and stuff like that, you're always starting with a blank page or blank canvas or empty cassette tape, and it's fun discovering what you have, like making the thing and seeing how it works and seeing how it fits in with everything else, and it bears mention too, it was a very small company. There was very few, like when I started, there was like 20 people in the office. And by the time we were doing video, you know, we had grown to like 40 or 50. And I felt like, oh, the company's huge now. But what was amazing was, you know, everybody came from really distinct backgrounds. A lot of us had been involved in some way, kind of in the orbit of, you know, the punk scene, wherever we'd come from, or just like the music scene or indie rock. Like, I was never like a punk, but I was really into like indie rock and shit like that. And so, you know, for better or worse, like the underground music and culture scene in whatever town we were from. And there was kind of a, we all had a, like a shared vocabulary of kind of cultural artifacts and of music and cinema and stuff like that. And we all had a shared sense of humor. You know, that was kind of one of the most essential things, advice, when I started and for a number of years thereafter. And it was the attitude, at least as I always felt it, was you can, like, especially when you started doing videos, like, you can come in, like, you can learn the technical stuff for video. You can learn how to operate a camera and how to make things very easily. You can watch a YouTube video and do that. But learning how to have that sense of humor and how to be able to, you know, riff with these people and how to kind of achieve that tone that we, I feel like, had in the magazine and then tried to transplant into video or whatever or reformulate was, it's like, that's the thing that you really can't quite teach. That's the thing you want to look for in people.
What did you find? I mean, I would say your pieces, both the written and video pieces, could be summarized as experiential journalism, okay, for the most part. Yeah. They involve you going somewhere and encountering people there and having firsthand experiences with them. So as you developed that style, like, what worked and didn't, like, work? Like, what were the disasters versus the successes among your first forays into that stuff?
It's interesting. The disasters, I feel like the disasters were almost kind of what ended up being the style. Like, everything, like, probably the first lesson I learned was just that, like, plans aren't going to work. On the very first shoot I did, everything I'd arranged fell through within an hour of showing up. And the rest of it just had to improvise and just go with the flow and figure out how things were going to work, since nothing that had been set up and arranged was going to happen.
Does that involve, like, changing sort of, like, what the story's going to be about?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And fortunately, I feel like I was really lucky to have come from, to have my background in writing articles. Because when you go to write an article about something and you go and visit the place and you're taking your notes and stuff like that, the article's not written. It's not, you know, you don't know what the ending is in your head. You're there to find out.
Yeah.
And you take all your notes and then you come home, you sit down at your computer, and then you come up with a story, you know? You're learning it while you're there. And so often, I see people in the video world, especially when they're, like, pitching things and, you know, trying to develop stuff, who kind of have, like, they've already figured it out, you know? They're like, here's what we're telling, you know, here's the conclusion we're trying to draw. And so we're going to go talk to these people and try to get that out of them, you know? And we're going to try to get this guy to say this to us and stuff like that. And that's great if you're making, like, a narrative film or, you know, a commercial video or something like that, because you don't have a lot of time to screw around. You want to know where all the parts are. But as far as if you're trying to learn something and document reality, I think that's a really great way to set yourself up to miss the story entirely. Thinking you already know it and going out just to, like, get your quotes from people, it's not just bad methodology, it's boring. Like, it's like, why would you even do that if you already know? If you already know what the person's going to say to you,
yeah,
why are you even going out there and talking to them? Like, what are you learning? What's anybody learning at that point?
What did you find, like, if the greatest distinction between the tech stuff and the video stuff is kind of like, with video, you've either got it or you don't have it, and you can't fly back and get it again. Like, when you're trying to manifest serendipity, but, like, on a clock with a budget, what did you learn about not sort of just like, oh, I know it, something needs to happen, but like, really, it needs to happen, like, during the day I'm there while the cameras are rolling.
I learned patience, which is the craziest thing, and it drives producers insane. But, and I don't know if it was just like, you know, kind of waiting at, like, if it was just playing, like, kind of Russian roulette with our budgets or not. But I found that, was like, things happen. There's always a story, like, if the subject's interesting enough to go see it and the person's interesting enough to go talk to them. And no matter how different that story is from what you think it's going to be, if you approach it with the same kind of, like, sense of curiosity and openness, something will always happen. Something's always good. Like, life's always going on around us. And, like, even, I mean, some of my favorite documentaries are, like, the Frederick Wiseman movies and stuff like that are things that capture just, like, these moments of absolute just quotidian normalcy. You know, just these, like, just little, like, just little gestures people make and shit like that that, you know, you see a million times a day. And that then kind of elevate that and make you, you know, like, make you appreciate it for the rich display of, you know, the fact that, you know, like, all human history, like, that person's entire ancestry has come together for them just to, like, sigh at that weird moment and kind of look at the clock. Like, there's something great about all that shit. And it's kind of a matter, you know, it's less a matter of waiting for serendipity to happen than seeing where it's already happening, you know? See, like, noticing what's going on around you that is worth filming, because almost everything is. Or there always is something that is worth filming, I feel like. And you can try to force it to happen, and sometimes it'll work, and sometimes it won't, and sometimes it'll look really corny, and sometimes you'll get away with it. But if you let it happen, I feel like it comes across. People notice it. Like, without a cast of professional actors who are, like, you know, Edward Norton grade good, like, you can't fake, you know, regular human casual interaction. Like, it's that is a thing that just, like, immediately comes across as, you know, it doesn't cross the valley of the uncanny if you're trying to fudge it.
When you think about that sense of human interaction, I would say that the style during most of Vice's history has always been to put a host, to put an eye into the story. I remember you did a story. I want to say this is for the Vice show on HBO, I think, where you went to a cancer clinic that treats cancer patients by having them smoke. Indonesia. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I know. That's crazy. It was, they weren't specifically a cancer clinic, but it was a clinic. And I can't remember the name of the practice that used tobacco, specifically smoked tobacco, to treat a variety of illnesses. And they claimed that, you know, it wasn't the tobacco smoke that was the problem that was causing all the cancer. It was something in the filters, and it was, you know, it's a bunch of crap with free radicals, which anytime you hear that term, usually means quackery is involved. And they were, you know, so they developed these, you know, new filters that you put on your cigarettes, and those were supposed to, you know, help get rid of your acne and cure your cancer and fix your hepatitis and all that jazz.
What, like, so in a story like that, you put yourself through the smoking cure, and that's usually a pretty good tactic, is to use yourself as the experimental subject. But I'm interested in, over time, like, how your conception of yourself as a character in these stories changed, and, like, how you avoid being, like, doing jackass.
Right.
When
when
so often you need to put yourself into the story experientially in that kind of a smoky kind of way.
Yeah.
Smoking cure kind of way, rather.
Yeah, it can be tricky. I think, because I never, you know, like, I never set out to do video stuff. And the first time I did a video piece on camera, I kind of assumed it was going to be the last. Like, it was like a weird, it almost felt like a weird dare. And even after having done it, I was sort of like, well, that's done with. They're going to see that and think it's garbage. So I don't know if I can go back to writing. This will be great. And maybe it came from that attitude, or maybe the attitude came from being able to, like, not think about the fact that there's a camera filming me and that eventually people are going to see it and stuff like that. That not trying to act for the camera just made it, I think, is, I mean, again, it's just like, yeah, trying to document serendipitous moments, you know, instead of trying to force them. Just acting natural is the easiest thing to do. And I was very fortunate to work with some, like, really good producers who were, like, really smart about not trying to make me do things, like, seeing what worked, seeing how it worked, and then just kind of like letting things happen, you know, helping arrange things, and then being like, you know, go talk to that person, see how it happens, and working with me too, not treating me like, I mean, one of the worst things in the fucking world, and you get a new producer and it suddenly, like, you know, acts like I'm some sort of like hired monkey who, like, you know, just comes in and you tell them the story and then they repeat the story there. Like, I've, you know, love working with producers to make the story, to come up with it in the first place, to like figure out who, you know, how we should go and attack it, all that jazz. And I think that, and that also helps too, that I always feel like I'm kind of like helping make something versus like just being the thing, the talent or the reporter. I think goes a long way towards, you know.
You talked about, when you were talking about Vice, there's a distinct sort of us versus them way to talk about it. And I think it's a natural way when you're working in a 20-person office. Of course it feels like us. And Vice is now thousands of people around the world, which is a very different us.
Yeah.
And there is something essentially different about reporting for a large company that's taken investment and is making big deals and is pushing its brand to every tentacle of the world through partnerships with YouTube, through a show with HBO. The stakes are like essentially different. And the person, you know, you brought up when we were talking about NYU, you mm-hmm. know, well, that's ultimately for the publisher or their, you know, that's ultimately in their interest.
Right.
And while it doesn't sound to me like what you did on a day-to-day level actually changed all that much over this period, like the pyramid on which you were standing was changing its foundation radically. I'm wondering if you could comment about that, about being a part of something larger that was once 1/20th and is now 1,000th and has all of these different connotations. Did that change your experience at all or your reporting at all?
It didn't change the reporting. It didn't change how I went into the field. And it was something I kind of kept in the back of my mind to not allow to creep in, creep into my thinking and to how I operated and how, you know, I worked with the different teams I worked with and making things. And for quite a number of years, I was very fortunate to be given kind of a large amount of leeway to do things how I thought they should be done, and how, you know, in a manner that kind of reflected the old sensibility that had worked. There was a shift that, you know, kind of gradually happened, and that I had to kind of gradually accept. Where at a point in like 2005 or 6, I knew everybody who worked at the company, and I'd go out drinking with them. I was friends with them, and I knew everything that came out. Like, I knew every article. Sometimes, like in the magazine, like I was the second to last kind of like copy editor. I'd put in all the changes. I'd, you know, fix all the errors I caught. And God, ooh, just remembered things. But I'd see everything that came out there, and to a degree could even have a say in it, in what we had done. And I felt when I'd go out and leave the office and run into people who'd have, you know, who'd complain or criticize a piece, something like that, I felt both compelled and capable of defending it, because I feel like I could, you know, at that time, I was so intimately involved with every little thing that, like, I could stand up for everything the company produced. I could, you know, I could testify to its intentions, to who the creator was, what the context of it was. Like, I could, you know, try to correct people in their thinking about why things had done and what had happened. And that was true even of the business deals too, you know, or like getting involved with Viacom and stuff like that. And that was always, you know, whenever news of that nature broke, it was always like, oh, Vice got bought by somebody and now they're owned by Viacom and now they're owned by, you know, Murdoch, and now they're owned by A&E and all that shit. And I felt very strongly about, you know, because I felt that, you know, all that shit reflected very heavily on me too, because I was one of, you know, the 20, 30, 40 people who were working there, that it was in my interest to, like, you know, defend that and stand up for it, and also to, like, you know, live up to the expectations of everybody else and the quality of content we were putting out. And over time, I had to, like, kind of let go. Like, we were making, you know, putting up like 20, 30, 50 posts a day, and, you know, everybody's out there making video. Like, it can't be, obviously, I can't be responsible in any way for, you know, kind of the decision making that's going on in any of those projects and what they, you know, look like when they come out. And I can't let it get to me that, like, you know, it's like, well, that's not really something, you know, it's like, like, I wouldn't have approached the story that way. And I don't, like, that's a bad joke, you know. I don't think I would have shot that. It's like, there's going to be stuff out there that I'm not as jazzed about. And the business deals are going to escape me, and I'm not going to understand, you know, exactly why we're doing certain things or why there's a new wing of the company or why this deal was being done. But yeah, all I can do is basically defend my little fiefdom and just make sure that doesn't change how I work and, you know, how I tell stories, how my team approaches telling stories when I'm working with, you know.
Yeah.
Make sure that doesn't creep into wherever I am.
The fiefdoms thing is interesting. I mean, you're not the only writer who sat there who, like, the story that immediately came to my mind when you started talking about that is I remember reading, after defending Vice, just because I'm sort of a defender of everything in a weird way,
yeah.
But, you know, someone complaining about, like, a noisy article that was like, I was like, why Jimi Hendrix is overrated or something.
Yeah.
And I can understand that anyone who is involved in storytelling just doesn't want their stuff sitting next to that on the shelf. It's not because that's immoral or unethical. It's weird. It's like people would almost think that the most offensive thing is like bad journalism. But
yeah.
To me, it's actually like just like cheap content farming is really, it's really where you don't want to sit. And I feel like it can feel a little bit like a contradiction where it's like, I want people to have resources to go to Indonesia to visit a quack clinic, but the modern economics dictate that one Why Jimi Hendrix Was Overrated article is necessary. It's actually not one, it's like 10,000 is necessary to send you there. All of those things, even when you try to stay in your fiefdom is like right next to the like Jimi Hendrix Is Overrated fiefdom.
Well, it's, and even as late as like, you know, in the last year, seeing stuff like that, like my instantaneous response is always like, crap, are we really saying that? As if somehow I'm involved with it, you
right
know? And you know, and then I run into people on the field and they'll be like, well, why'd you say that thing about, you know, why'd you say that thing about Cardi B? And I'm like, I didn't say that, like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, that's a totally different person. For a company of 5,000 people, like, are you really going to hold me accountable for a blog post you read 5 years ago by somebody who doesn't even work there anymore? You know, like,
yeah,
it's a ridiculous standard for other people to hold somebody to. But then I also, like, I understand in that I definitely just mentally hold myself to that no matter what and just have to kind of talk myself out of it.
I don't think any one person is personally responsible for a Why Jimi Hendrix Is Overrated article.
It
takes like an entire business model, advertising team. I mean, it takes a lot of people have to make a lot of decisions before it's getting made. And so it's a weird thing. It's like a monster that no one can say single-handedly, like, I tried to make this thing.
Yeah.
Which makes it interesting for me in really thinking about this Jill Abramson thing, not just in a haha, that sucks kind of way, which is, I think, probably my first reaction was kind
Mine
of like,
too.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Is no one person, like, no one person can be singled out and be like emblematic of the entire narrative of Vice,
yeah,
a company with 5,000 people. You were a particularly bad choice, but I don't really think that if anyone ends up being the face of that section of the book, it really is quite fair. In a way, it feels like, and this is also, of course, a microcosm for the whole thing, like, the employees become a pawn in a larger game.
Yeah, sure.
And I wonder, like, how that feels. That you're
so
in
does
some
the
way...
boss, though, too.
Yeah.
Frankly, like, you know, how can you hold a guy who's, you know, flying around and doing whatever business deals he's making at the time responsible for something, an employee who started 2 weeks ago he's never met, who, you know, is just, like, writing your, you know, the Jimi Hendrix blog post. It, you know, it's his company. Of course he should, you know, how wouldn't he be responsible for what his company puts out? But it's like, yeah, there's 5,000 people and there's different countries. And I feel like hopefully there's a good faith kind of argument that everybody's just trying to do their best thing. But I'm sure there's some screw ups, you know?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a certain person who would say that part of the reason why the New York Times has the don't accept that cup of coffee policy is to provide a structure for that person who was hired 2 weeks ago so that the CEO of the New York Times company doesn't have to answer for them.
Exactly. And that's, and that ultimately is to defend the company. And that's, I think that's true too of like the first thing that struck me when I was in reporting one was that they were teaching everybody to write the same. And that's newspaper journalism. That's the model at its barest level. Like you flatten anybody's individual writing style, any of their like choices they would make in writing, and you tell them exactly what information goes where. This is exactly how you write this story. This is exactly, you know, you have a formula for writing the blog post, the article, whatever you need. Everything has a recipe that you have to follow. And that way you can ensure that you have a consistent product. I don't think media should have consistent products, though, like not if it's to be considered like a creative enterprise. And I think if you're the head of a company like that and it's, you know, it gets to be that big, there has to be, if you want it to be creative, like, I mean, and I'm trying to think, it's like approaching the head of a movie studio and being like, well, why did you, like, why was that movie lit that way? There has to be, I guess, kind of a degree of trust or agency that, you know, you're allowed to grant your employees that it, you hopefully, you know, pays dividends in the fact that they'll come up with things that, you know, are inspired and creative and that you're proud of having, you know, given them the money for and stuff like that. But it's like, these are all elements of doing something that are not safe. And that's, you know, ultimately, I feel like business, the business sense is always geared towards the side of safety, of protecting the overall company and the interests of whatever financial backers they've got, of the board, all that jazz. Creative enterprises are inherently not safe. They're about taking risks. They're about trying to make something that, you know, you have in your head or you want to make that's new and bringing it into the world.
I mean, I think that's kind of my ultimate criticism of what I read of this book. Not to put on my critics, I'm only allowed to put it on for 60 seconds per episode, but it doesn't really feel like you're pushing back against her assessment of Vice. I mean, you would push back against it, but it's almost premature to even push back against it because it's so clearly formed prior, outside of the reporting of this book, as evidenced by, you are certainly not emblematic of the conclusion that she comes to about Vice, which just leads me to believe that this is just an opinion of Vice, which is actually fine. I think it's like fine to write a critical opinion of Vice and be like a media critic. It feels weird to like bring a real person's real life into that enterprise.
And then to rearrange and fabricate the details of it to suit that opinion.
Yeah.
To fit your bias. Yeah, it's... Yeah. The whole thing's just ugly.
And
I think I said in the Medium piece too, it was like, if her conclusion is that, you know, Vice does things in a kind of unprofessional, amateur sort of way, like there's, you know, like you could have easily made that point in a different manner without having to stray from the truth, you know? And like, personally, I've always been like, it was something I talked to Jill about too. I was like, I think that's a strong suit. I think a lot of our great successes have been kind of won on the back of us not adhering to, you know, strict professional standards, that taking a certain kind of amateur approach to things can sometimes open up the door to like completely new avenues of discovery and information, you know. So
how does it leave you thinking about sort of the larger idea that a person or a person's experience, their story, can tell a larger story? Because I think we rely on that idea a lot in journalism. And you've now had your human experience over the last 15 years turned into a book. And on one level, I think we can just sort of almost discard this because we know this was not your actual human experience.
Right.
But there's a different book where she might have written about your actual human experience and used your actual human experience maybe to tell a more subtle or fully rounded story about Vice. But you still would be the pawn in that story.
Well, and people have done that, and people have done that very successfully, and not just in nonfiction. I mean, that's, you know, that's what novels are about when they're good, you know. And I think it's a matter of craft at that point. You know, it's about like, I mean, she did like the thing that I keep seeing repeated in the responses to her is, you know, without having to even get into, like, was it plagiarism? Was it cited? Did I actually, like, do the donkey fucking story? Was that a completely different person?
Yeah.
Which it was. Without even getting into all that stuff, it was just sloppy. There was something very, very sloppy and unfocused and careless about the way she addressed this. And I think, like, if you're not, like, invested enough to do a good job with things and it shows in your output that you're just, like, you're apathetic about your subjects or just, like, because the, you know, the negativity, the, like, the hit job nature of it was, like, one of the things that, like, and I cannot believe, like, this is the hill Abramson's trying to die on, like, that she's, like, stood her ground and been, like, and directly lied and said, like, oh, Vice was given plenty of a chance to review the material and, like, look it over. And it's, like, nobody I've talked to got any opportunity before, just, like, unless she's referring to the fact that they sent out galleys, like, that does not meet any, like, does not meet the standards of, like, being allowed to review the text, like... I mean, I guess, like, you're talking about writing a review, but, like, it's just false. And we, you know, like, I debated when I'd read it and I'd kind of started logging the errors and I was writing the piece. I was like, well, you know, do I send this to Simon & Schuster? Do I put this up before the book goes out and maybe they'll change things? Or, you know, do I wait and there's a hard copy and then I can get them, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, no. I was like, I want it to go up. I don't want this to be on the record. Like, that's and I definitely don't want to, like, I understand the economics of, you know, publishing a book and then having to pulp it or something like that. And that's crazy. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. So I'm not going to just, like, sit on this until I can be like, haha. I kind of hope they would retract it, you know? And at first, when it was just, like, a few casual errors, when it was, like, the first, I can't remember the name of the reporter first, said that she'd been described by Jill with all these details wrong, and it was, you know, it was, like, five or six details. And
yeah, including, like, her, yeah, gender identity.
Including her gender, yeah.
It's a big one.
No joke. Well, to me, it was including the color of her shoes. It was just, like, why? Like, yeah. why did you even need to include that detail if you're not going to get it fucking right? It's like the one of my biggest beefs is when she's screwing up the chronology of everything I told her, that at one point she describes, and she might have, like, I understand that she's changing the EPUB as this goes on, which is, like, such a weird, like, she's so, like, opposed to digital media, and she's, like, doing this, like, constant editing and revision of it.
She's a Life
even though
of Pablo
it's
fan.
A book, like, ah, oof. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing's just mind-boggling. But there was, at one point, she had described, I think it was two or three different shoots of mine, and she'd gotten them very much out of order. And it was bad enough that she was presenting them out of order, because, you know, that kind of destroys the context in which things happened. But she, for whatever reason, or whoever, like, her writing assistant or whoever, for whatever reason, decided to say that I had flown from one shoot to the other. And so I took a flight from a shoot in 2011 to a shoot in 2013. And from there, I got on a plane and went to 2009. You know, I was like, yeah. Why did I have to fly?
Right.
Like, why was that even necessary? Like, what a weird, yeah.
Well, it's interesting also because, I mean, the ending of the story has got, like, you having been dumped or broken up with your girlfriend and you're, like, sick. And
I'm sleeping on someone's couch.
Sleeping on someone's couch. And Shane Smith, the CEO, is accepting a fancy journalism award, I think.
Yeah.
Which is...
Everybody's laughing with their champagne glasses.
I've defended Aaron Sorkin for doing, like, the same thing with the Facebook story. And I think that is what a good writer does. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That is what a good... Yeah. Fiction writer does is make all the strands tie together and all of the themes have been put into a perfect braid that ends in a final scene. But life is so much messier than that. And when we start sort of playing with those dynamics in nonfiction, you kind of, like, lose all of the appeal of nonfiction. Like, I don't even have a particular interest in reading this book because, yeah, like, I know a lot about these new and old media companies. I've talked to a lot of people who've worked at them, and it's like, well, if I don't feel like there's, like, that connective tissue of truthiness,
when it doesn't feel real, yeah,
it's hard for me to invest emotionally in the life of Thomas Morton.
No kidding, right?
So where do you go from here? What have you started thinking about the next act of your life?
For sure, yeah. There's a lot of stuff I wanted to work on in the last year that I didn't get a chance to for various reasons. So I'm excited to kind of be able to go find places and people with whom to do that. I use an index card system to kind of organize my thoughts and ideas, and I have a lot. I have a lot of index cards.
It's a big stack.
I have a lot, yeah.
I feel if this was like the crappy movie version, you'd go home right now and the index cards would be like sitting next to your windowsill and a strong wind would just blow them all away. Yeah. Like, it's all gone.
I've got this green box I keep them in doesn't happen. Okay, yeah, yeah. Safe. And a beautiful, I have a paperweight that my girlfriend bought me that is an actual, it actually works as a paperweight. I'm looking forward to doing a lot more writing. I'd gotten, because by the, like 2 years ago when I was making the TV show, at one point, you know, like 5 or 6 years ago, I was doing kind of a even balance of video work and writing, and pretty quickly as the video work picked up and there was more and more of it, I got away from being able to write as much as I had and as much as I liked, and I miss it a lot. I deeply enjoy it. Like, I mean, as big a pain in the ass as it was putting together this whole Medium thing to respond to the Jill Abramson book, I did enjoy writing it, like, and I enjoyed having a piece of writing, getting it finished and put up and editing it, and then the response, which I enjoyed to a degree. So I'm looking forward to doing a lot more of that, a lot more writing, and hopefully, and then some video stuff, because that pays the bills, you know?
What, how do you reflect on dedicating such a large portion of your life to one company, one publisher, one brand? I mean, it feels like now for someone who was 22 coming into the working world, the idea of spending 15 years at a media company is like insane. Like, if you last 2 years,
it was
you
crazy
have like
when
a
I was 22,
gray beard. And it's a, you know, generally the kind of people who end up putting 15 years in your life or something usually work either for like the New York Times or, you know, for Ford or Coca-Cola or something like that. You know, it's a rare connection to have so much of your life be tied up with a single company. Now that you're at the tail end of it, how do you reflect on it?
I mean, first and foremost, I was super lucky to be to have had all the opportunities I got through Vice. Like, you know, when I showed up there as an intern, I was looking forward to hopefully a summer of, you know, bouncing in and out of the office and like maybe getting to write a record review or something like that. And to have, you know, gone through 14 and a half years making a living, like writing for a magazine that I loved, getting to learn how to make videos, getting to work with a lot of the people who were, you know, who's like writing and video making I really admired, and getting to, it was great. Like, it was fucking great. It was the best, like, and you know, like Williamsburg in like the 2000s is like the best place to be a 20-year-old. It was so much fucking fun. And I look back on all that and there's, you know, it's like there's a nice tidy record of things. I don't think I slacked off in making things. I'm happy with the stuff I made. And if we'd been talking like a year and a half or 2 years ago, I'd like up to that point, it was, everything was absolutely fantastic, better than I could have expected with that. Last year or so has been frustrating due to like kind of like office politics and shit like that. And you know, you can see that in drastically diminished output. But it was a good, I don't regret giving my youth there. I think I got a lot of things. I got to do a lot of things I never would have gotten to do anywhere else. And and now I'm psyched to move on. I think it's, you know, the jolt of getting canned like out of the blue was angering for a minute. And then I thought it would be like, oh crap, now I'm going to be all depressed for a couple weeks. But the next feeling I got was just sort of like, oh no, it's like, it was kind of like a feeling of liberation, like, or man, liberation's really fucking, that's hyperbolic. I felt that oppression never came. I felt relieved. There was a feeling of relief. It's like, you know, auguring in the transition and working out all the, you know, the P's and Q's are going to be, it's going to be a lot of work over the next little bit, but I'm excited about moving forward and doing things and taking everything that I've picked up over the years and applying it to new projects.
Now that there is a semi-fictionalized account of your career out there, do you have any urge to write about your own experiences?
Probably.
Or do the My Merchants of Truth?
Most likely. Yeah, at some point. Fuck knows if it's going to be in the next like 5 years or when I'm like 70 and about to die.
All right, well, this show's been running for over 6 years, so we have a good chance of making it till you're 70. So will you come back on and tell me about it when the time comes?
Yeah, of course.
All right, thank you very much for this interview.
If we can fit my hospital bed through that door.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, I really appreciate you listening to the Long Form Podcast, as do my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Janelle Pfeiffer. Our intern is Tyler McCloskey. We are brought to you through the generous support of people like MailChimp. Go sign up for an email newsletter. People are crazy for the email newsletters. And of course, thanks to Thomas Morton for coming in and doing this on the news cycle. We like to hit it at least once per year. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.